Hi, this is Lewis Leader with KAZU, the National Public Radio Station based in Monterey and environs. We're here today to interview Jimmy Panetta, who's an announced candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 20th Congressional District. The district is currently represented by Sam Farr, but Sam has decided after approximately 23 years he will not be seeking re-election this year, so we will have a new congressman or congresswoman. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you. Thank you, Lou, and thank you to KAZU for giving me this opportunity. I appreciate it.
And we thank you for being here. Jimmy, I wanted to start a little bit, let the public know a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure.
You're a prosecutor in Monterey County, where you grew up. You've been working assigned to the gang team in Salinas. You've been prosecuting a considerable number of criminal street gang members. Prior to that, you worked is in Alameda County, the district attorney's office. And while you were there, you worked for the California AG's office. You wrote and argued legal briefs in the California appellate and Supreme Court systems. You got your law degree from Santa Clara University, your undergraduate degree at UC Davis in international relations. Prior to that, you went to Monterey Peninsula College and Carmel High. And in between college and law school, you worked on missile and chemical weapons nonproliferation for the U.S. Department of State and for the then Monterey Institute of International Studies, now the Middlebury Institute. You were commissioned as an officer for the U.S. Navy Reserve in 2003. In 2007, you were mobilized to active duty and deployed to Afghanistan. And in service there, you were awarded the Bronze Star Medal for Meritorious Service. You served on many boards in the area. Your wife is Carrie Panetta. She's a judge in Monterey County. And you have two young daughters. Does that pretty much sum it up in a brief nutshell?
Yes, that's correct. I also worked, I think, which was a good experience, in between college and law school. I worked for a National Oceanic and Atmospheric ship, the NOAA ship Rainier, up there off the coast of Alaska, doing environmental and hydrographic research.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that goes more to your background. Jimmy, one first question. You, at the age of, I guess you were 33, you decided to join the Naval Reserve as an intelligence officer in February of 2003. At the time you were married, had two little girls, or had they been born yet? I'm unsure.
No. In 2003, I was engaged.
Okay.
So no children yet.
Why did you decide to join? That seems like, 33 is not old, but in the relative specter of joining the military service, it's a little on the elderly side.
Look, joining the military is something that I always wanted to do. Growing up in this area, which is heavily influenced by the military and the military spirit of service for our country and obviously this community, I saw many veterans and many service members who were here working at the former Fort Ord Navy Postgraduate School and, of course, Defense Language Institute and many of the other military institutions that serve this area. So I was influenced by them and also my father's service during his time and seeing the pictures. I wasn't born yet when he was serving as an intelligence officer here at Fort Ord, but there were many aspects of being from here and living in my family, being from my family, that influenced me to join the military. And so I got to an age where I said to myself, I better do this now before I regret not doing it. And I was engaged. Carrie and I were living in San Francisco at that time, and I was working full-time at the Alameda County DA's office, and so was she. And so I posed the question to her of wanting to join the reserve. And being from the family that she is, from North Dakota, she understood that sense of commitment and that sense of service. And she said, that's fine, of course.
Which question did you propose first, marriage or joining the military?
I locked her in first. It was marriage first.
You mentioned your father, obviously an extremely well-known figure on the Monterey Peninsula and in government. He was first elected to Congress in 1976. He served in Congress for nearly 17 years. And subsequent to that, he ran the CIA. He was ran the Department of Defense. He's clearly an extremely well-known figure, not only in local politics, but in national politics. This is your first attempt at public office. You're running for Congress. Did you consider running for something else as a stepping stone, perhaps the Board of Supervisors, the State Assembly, or State Senate?
Yeah, no. I mean, the answer is posed in that question is, you know, I would not want to run for an office where I knew it would be a stepping stone. That would be a disservice to the people that I would represent in that position. I feel that based on my commitment to this area and my commitment to service of this community and our country and what I have done in my adult life, I am qualified to represent this area in Congress. What inspires me is what you alluded to, and that's having seen the work it takes to be a good politician. It's not easy. There's no doubt about that. It's not easy on you, on the representative, and it's not easy on your family.
You grew up in a political family. I believe you were, 9 years old when your dad was elected to Congress? Or seven?
7 years
old. 7 years old.
Second grade.
Your dad did not grow up in a political family. It was more of a working class family. Your dad's father was, I think, a restaurateur, and they also raised walnuts out on the farm in Carmel Valley. What was it like for you growing up in a very political family?
Well, my parents did their best, and they did an excellent job in keeping us separate from the politics, keeping us separate from the reasons why they worked so hard. There was a conscious decision on their part as to whether or not they were going to raise us in Washington, D.C., or raise their three boys here in the area where my father was born and raised. And it was a no-brainer. They wanted us to have the same sense of belonging that they did, a sense of belonging to this area and to the people of this area. And so growing up, you know, I knew my parents worked very hard. And as you know, my mother was my father's unpaid volunteer district director. And they worked their butts off. There's no doubt about it. They worked very hard to serve the people of this area. And I knew they worked hard. But I got to tell you, growing up, we never really knew why. They didn't bring politics to the kitchen table. They wanted us to live our own lives. And they did that by allowing us to be kids in Carmel Valley.
And the name Panetta, let me throw the $64 question out there. I expect you've heard it. Obviously, it's a well-recognized and respected name. There were people who say if your name was, say, Jimmy Mercurio or Jimmy Sanchez or Jimmy Thompson, it would be a whole different ballgame. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, I say that's right. I say don't just look at the name. Look at me. I know people know the name, but they need to know me. And if you talk to people who know me and who support me, and if you look at my endorsements, it's not because of the name. It's because of what I have done in my past and demonstrating my commitment to service. But Lou, welcome to my life. Welcome to my life. That's something that I've grown up with. People automatically assuming things about me just based on my last name. And so I've realized that, yes, because of what my father did, because of what my mother did for the people of this area, it can be a benefit, but it can also hurt me as well. And in that sense, it's always been left up to me to get myself through that door. That's why I served in the military. That's why I served in the streets and in the courtrooms of Oakland and in Salinas. And that's why I served on the numerous boards that I did in this area. Because I did it not because of my name. I did it because of where I'm from and my sense of belonging, which led to my sense of service.
Let's talk about your goal to be a congressperson from the area. Congress never really comes close to being high on list of Americans' favorites. A new Rasmussen report shows that only 9% of likely voters, and this is a report from last month, think Congress is doing a good or excellent job. A higher percentage of Americans feel their own congressperson is doing a better job, but it's never been overwhelming. What do you need to do? What does any member of Congress need to do to overcome this feeling that Americans have toward Congress?
Yeah. Well, I was fortunate enough to spend time back in Washington, D.C. when I worked for the State Department. And what was a great experience about that, I was an international relations major, and every naive IR major, their goal is to work at the State Department in some capacity. And so I was fortunate enough to have that opportunity to work with the nonproliferation issues dealing with chemical weapons and missile technology. But what I learned from that time is that I didn't want to work in the State Department. And the reason I say that is because of what I learned in my own apartment in Washington, D.C. When I had the fortunate opportunity to live with my father and his three roommates, who are also congressional members. And during that time, my father and I shared a full-size bed in the living room with Chuck Schumer, who was about 10 feet from us on the fold-out couch. And upstairs was George Miller, a congressman from the North Bay up in Martinez area here in California, and Marty Russo, a Chicago congressman. And being able to spend time with my father, being able to spend time with not just those other representatives, but every night, these representatives would make it a point to go out to dinner, to get to know one another, to develop their personal chemistry, and I am confident and I guarantee you that's what led to their ability to professionally compromise. And if you look at this article that came out recently, about 3-4 weeks ago, by Tom Daschle and Trent Lott, two former senators, one a Republican, one a Democrat, they talked about four things that is necessary to make Congress relevant again. Congressional members need vision, they need leadership, they need compromise, but the most important thing they said is chemistry. Bring back the chemistry amongst the members. And if you look at the new Congress members that are coming into Congress, they are clearly bringing a spirit of collaboration that has been missed in the past decade. And what you have is young congressional members coming in there, creating caucuses such as the United Solutions Caucus, which I don't know if they get much done. But the fact is that Democrats, Republicans come together, talk about things, and get to know one another. And that leads to their ability to work with one another. I saw it done before, and I know it can be done again.
That's a fairly optimistic analysis of the new Congress. There's been a tremendous stalemate in the last decade. In your father's book, A Memoir, Worthy Fights, A Memoir of Leadership in War and Peace, he talks a lot about the collegial spirit that was going on in Congress, Democrats and Republicans getting along together and compromising. It's no secret that a lot of people feel that the compromise has not really occurred in the halls of Congress in the last decade. There were those who would challenge your optimistic spirit. We look at some of the measures that have not really pushed ahead, compromise. I wanted to get back to Simpson-Bowles in a little bit. But what gives you this sense of that Democrats and Republicans, as they did in the Reagan administration, as they did in the Clinton administration, will be able to coalesce, and even in the Bush administrations, coalesce and work for the betterment of the country?
Look, I agree. You first started off this interview by talking about how the reputation of Congress has been diminished. And in some way, I mean, you're right. There's no doubt about that. And unfortunately, the traditional virtues of our democracy have bowed to the noisy, visceral divisions of partisanship. And people, representatives, people who support our democracy, need to realize that we need to bring back a bipartisanship approach to solving things. Now, the issues that are facing this Congress are big issues. You cannot just basically kill some villain and solve the issues. These are systemic problems that need big solutions. So rather than take Congress out of the equation, which has been done, unfortunately, and what do you expect with a Republican House leader who said that his goal was not to create laws, but he wanted his goal to be how many laws he repealed. And when you have leadership like that and statements like that, obviously it doesn't contribute to the bipartisan spirit that's necessary in Washington, D.C. But I think that with this approach by these younger congressional members who are coming in there, who are hearing from their constituents that they're fed up with the inaction in Washington, D.C., that these Congress members need, they don't need the motivation. I think they have the motivation, and I think they have the willingness to reach across the aisle. I mean, and that's what I'm going to, that's what I plan if I'm fortunate enough to get elected. I hope to bring that attitude, the attitude I use every day in court, in which I reach across to the defense attorneys to talk about your cases. You have to do that. And I have that ability based on my background. On top of that, look, being in Washington, one representative told me, look, it's easy to be an average congressional member. Go in, cast a vote, you do your constituent services, you go home. But the fact is I told that to another congressional member, and he said, well, yeah, of course. But you know what? When you get things done, that's when it's fun. And that's what it's about.
Let's talk about getting things done. You've got tremendous experience as a prosecutor. President Obama's criminal justice reform initiatives focused on cutting back on the war on drugs philosophy of the 80s that resulted in the crowded and overcrowded prisons and with a disproportionate impact on minorities. He's gotten Republican support on some of this. Where do we go from here regarding such initiatives and overcrowding of prisons?
Well, look, I think in that role, you also have to look at what the state has done, because that's what's affected the criminal justice system here locally, in the sense that you had AB 109 removing low-level offenders from the state prisons, bringing them down into the counties. You had Proposition 47, which reduced low-level felonies to misdemeanors. And so I think that the intent of those propositions, of that legislation, was to take people out of the prison system. And we've done a good job taking people out of our prisons, out of our county jails. However, we need to work on issues that keep people from jail. And what I mean by that is, look, yeah, you're right. I was a gang prosecutor. And prosecuting violent gang members who committed very heinous and horrific crimes, I could do my job and I could remove that person from the street and protect the public. But one of the most frustrating times that I've been a prosecutor is when I was in general felonies. And I was working with a case in which I looked over at the defendant and you could clearly tell that there was a mental issue. And I looked at the police report and you could clearly tell that the reason this person was charged with a crime was because of that person's mental issue. And that if I was to prosecute that person, this person would go to county jail, he'd be right back on the street, and he'd be right back in the same position. If I was to dismiss the case, he'd be right back on the street and right back in the same position. So I think we need to look at mental health as a significant issue when it comes to reviewing and renewing our crime prevention.
Let's take a look at, if you don't mind, what happened in the crash of the economy in 2008. There are some people who said there should have been some criminal prosecutions for Wall Street bankers. Millions of Americans got damaged. There was a bailout by the government. Obviously, you're not the Attorney General, and you're not seeking that position. But did the government let those people off too easily?
Well, I know that the government felt that those institutions were too big to fail, as they say. And that is why they had the bailout, because I think what the administration was looking at was the larger picture in not letting the country suffer any longer than was necessary by letting those institutions go under. So you understood the bailouts that were done, but you also have to look at the after effects, and you look at the situation of our economy today in the sense that, you know, we have created, what, over 14 million jobs. We have cut unemployment in half. The auto industry has had its best year ever. And then you look at locally what's been going on here. You talk to farmers here. They've had one of their best years in a long time. The agricultural industry is booming. You talk to people in the tourism industry here locally.
I'm sorry.
Our economy is doing well, and if you have to take that into account when looking at what was done back in 2008 and subsequent to that.
Let's take a look at the local economy. A teacher friend said she and her husband have looked for every possible house availability in Marina, and there was nothing livable under $500,000. Should we be having subsidies for teachers? Is there any way to resolve the chronic housing, not only a housing shortage problem, but a reasonable housing shortage problem? What can or should be done?
Yeah, no, there is no doubt that there is an issue when it comes to affordable housing, not just in Marina, not just in Monterey County, but throughout the Central Coast. And there needs to be, obviously, remedies when it comes to this situation. And there needs to be more housing stock. There needs to be more affordable housing for people to come here, for people to come back here, to people to live here, and for people to serve here. And so we need to encourage more affordable housing. We need to make sure that, yes, that there possibly are public housing trust for people who teach, people who serve as firemen, people who serve as police officers, people who serve as prosecutors, people who serve as defense attorneys, public defenders. We want people to serve in this area, but we also want people to live in this area. We don't want people driving 2 hours to come in to Monterey County so that they work here. Why? Because that doesn't give them the sense of belonging that I had. It doesn't give them the sense of family that I had, because those 2 hours in commute are basically 2 hours away from their family. And when they're away from their family, they're away from this community.
Speaking of the commute, you're backing the half-cent local sales tax in November to pay for Highway 1 auxiliary lanes and local road maintenance. A similar measure was defeated several years ago. You cannot get to, say, Monterey Peninsula without going on a two-lane road somewhere, Highway 1, Highway 17, Highway 68. Do you think this measure has a reasonable chance of being passed?
Look, in regards to that half-cent measure, I think it would be a good idea for the number of reasons that they have laid out. Yes, it would allocate funds to the rail trail. Yes, it would allocate funds to three auxiliary lanes there on Highway 1. Yes, it would provide money for paratransit in the area. And, of course, it would provide the needed funds for our infrastructure that has been so lacking in the past decade. And that's what basically it's going to be left up to at this point, in the sense that it's up to the locals to raise this money in order to develop their infrastructure. Now, what's also beneficial is that then they can then use that money to leverage it to obtain federal funds, especially with the FAST Act that was just passed in December, I think $305 billion over the next 5 years. And basically, the representative of this area will work to ensure that some of that money comes our way.
In an article in the Monterey County Herald on January 21st, you were quoted as saying, you can raise the gas tax, but with fuel efficiency, is that going to work? Maybe bring back earmarks. Earmarks became a dirty word about 6 years ago. These are federal funds that are set aside or earmarked for local projects. Can you go into that a little bit more, sure, your sensing on earmarks?
Sure. Well, let me back up. I mean, with the gas tax, I mean, that's been the old reliable, unfortunately. But fortunately for us, we've created cars that have higher fuel efficiency. People have gotten out of the cars. They are not driving as much. So that's basically a declining source of revenue. And we can't sit there and continue to say gas tax, gas tax. And so you have to look at things like where there was an article in the paper today about the VMT, the vehicle miles traveled, and whether or not that's something in order to tax so that they can develop revenue in that way. And so there has to be other ways that we can maintain a source of revenue from the government. Now, earmarks is something that allowed representatives to bring projects and bring funding into their local communities. That was important. If you look at the representatives around here, they used earmarks to get things done in this area. Unfortunately, the House Republican leadership took those out of the equation, and they're no longer be able to use. But guess what? That's also why we haven't seen funding come into this area for vital infrastructure projects. And so, yes, it would be something to consider in reinstating earmarks for projects that deal with instrumental infrastructure in our area.
We're interviewing Jimmy Panetta, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination in the 20th Congressional District, which includes Monterey and Santa Cruz counties, and some of San Benito and Santa Clara counties. This will be an open seat. This is Lewis Leader on the NPR station KAZU. At an appearance in Santa Cruz a few days ago, you said your first priority is immigration reform. Obviously, immigration is not only a national issue, but it's a significant issue here. And you said hopefully in 2017 the Republican leadership will be ready to bring it forward. We've had a particularly mean campaign for president. Donald Trump has continually said about rounding up so-called illegal Mexican immigrants, sending them back, and then bringing the good ones back. Where do we go on immigration, both on a national perspective and on a more local perspective?
Yeah, the rhetoric out of the Republican contenders, who are the leaders in the latest polls, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, it's disgusting. It's despicable and it's dishonorable because that type of rhetoric is not what this country stands for. We are not a nation whose beacon is a wall. We're a nation whose beacon is the Statue of Liberty. And it was the same Statue of Liberty that my grandfather saw when he came through Ellis Island back in 1921. So I come from a family that started with my grandfather was allowed to take advantage of the opportunities that this country had to offer. And he came all the way here through to California because it reminded him of Calabria, where he lived. And so being a nation of immigrants that we are, a nation of risk takers, has made this country great. And so you have to realize that immigration is a priority for the nation and for this community, because I was fortunate enough to take an ag focus class up in Santa Cruz County through the Farm Bureau for the last 9 months in the previous year. And every farmer I spoke to in that class and subsequent to the class, what they tell me is that, yes, water is an issue, but the most pressing issue for them is immigration, because we live in an area with more crops than any other single state in the union. These are specialty crops. These are crops that you can't just bring a machine through the field to harvest these crops. You need human sight, sense, and touch in order to pick these berries, pick these artichokes, cut the lettuce, because they need to determine what's aesthetically pleasing to the consumer. And so having a adequate labor force for that industry is essential in this area. And it's unfortunate that Congress has yet to produce any sort of resolution in dealing with comprehensive immigration reform. And the frustrating part is back in 2013, when the Senate had their bill that they put forward, that was a solution. It was a comprehensive immigration reform, but unfortunately, the Republican House leadership failed to bring it forward. And it's unfortunate that Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of their House, continues to not bring that forward, despite the President, because of his executive action that he was forced to take. So what I'm hoping is when there is a new administration, no matter who it is, that this issue will come up again. And I look forward, if I'm so fortunate enough to be in that position, to work on that issue, not just because of what it means to this community, but what it means to our country.
Well, let me throw two words at you and get a response from you. Budget, national deficit, actually three words. It's an ever-burgeoning problem and difficulty for the country. Paying off the debt on the I guess you might say the tax on the on the budget. The interest is an ever-increasing problem. Where do we go? What do we do? How did we get there? That's a couple of easy questions.
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, we had two wars that we basically financed with our future. And so the budget is at a state, the deficit is in a position to where it is hurting our future. I mean, we have sacrificed our present. We have sacrificed our future for our present, unfortunately. And so we can't keep on shifting the future. We can't keep on shifting that burden onto our children. And so there are sacrifices that are going to have to be made. And you can look at entitlements, but the fact is that without hurting our senior citizens and the needy, that those are something that's going to have to be on the table. Everything's going to have to be on our table in order to bring that deficit down.
Speaking of that, what's your feeling on Simpson Bowles, which was the bipartisan Senator Alan Simpson, Republican, and Congressman Erskine Bowles, to try to get the country off the road toward more debt and deficits? How do you feel about Simpson Bowles?
No, I understand. I mean, that was, they came up with that back in, what was that, 2012?
I'm not sure. The commission first met in 2010.
Exactly.
And then issued a report later that year.
And it was unfortunate. I mean, from what I gathered, is that they put forward some very good ideas that took a lot of sacrifice. But I think at that time, the administration and the government was not willing to make those sacrifices, it seemed. And it appeared that they went a different way than that, which is unfortunate. But those types of ideas, with those types of sacrifices, are something that should be on the table as well.
Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission in 2010 basically freed PACs and then was expanded, also freed labor unions and other associations to give as much money as they want to campaigns, to candidates. That's been both roundly criticized and others have praised it. What's your take on Citizens United?
Well, Citizens United is unfortunately something that we have to deal with now. And it's a decision that I think contributes to the partisanship in Washington, D.C., because you have a number of special interests who are able to donate huge sums, ridiculous sums of money to certain representatives and help get them elected. And I think that's unfortunate, and I would hope that it be reconsidered in the future.
Let's turn to, speaking of finances, Glass-Steagall Act dates to the Depression. It's in this presidential campaign. It's partial repeal back in 99, some blame for much of the financial crisis of 08, 09. It had imposed a kind of a regulatory separation between banking and higher-risk investing activities. What's your take on Glass-Steagall? Should we be giving that another look? Should we be restoring the portions that were partially repealed?
I think you look to the response of the president who repealed that and what he's saying now, and that President Clinton has even said that he should not have done that. And I agree with him. I think that's something that should be looked at. There are certain facets of it that should be reinstated.
Let's turn our attention now to the Mideast. The U.S. and Israel have had historically close ties. President Truman recognized Israel almost immediately in 1948 after it became a state. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Some say we're too close to Israel. Others say perhaps we're not close enough for what Israel represents and what it's gone through. It's about 1/6 of 1% of all the land in the Mideast. Relations between President Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel have been frosty for quite a while. They're certainly not close. What should the U.S. Policy be toward Israel, and what should it be toward the greater Middle East? And then I want to go into some other points there.
Look, in regards to Israel, they are the only democracy in the Middle East. And so it's important that we continue our close relationship with Israel and ensuring that they have the right to defend themselves and to determine that defense and what is necessary to ensure that their country is safe and secure. I look forward to visiting Israel one day because the people that I've spoke to that have been there has completely changed their perspective as to how and why Israel comes up with its policies. Because I think by going to a country in which being able to visit a country in which they endure terrorist attacks on basically a daily and a weekly basis, I think would change anybody's perspective. The stabbings that are going on, the bombings that are going on, I think that people need to have more empathy as to what the Israelis are going through. In that sense, we have to support them in their two-party talks and making sure that both sides come to the table. Abbas and Netanyahu come to the table in order to discuss the two-state solution. Unfortunately, at this point, it seems that there is no credibility given to one side on this issue, and with Abbas is what I have read, in the sense that he's too old, or even the Palestinians don't trust him in what not trust him, but don't have faith in his leadership as well. And so I think it's something that unfortunately is not going to get solved anytime soon. Nevertheless, it's something we should continue to make sure at least is resolved.
Let's using that as a jumping point. Let me throw a few at you. Can Iraq exist as it is? It was kind of created by, you might say, imperialistic decree. There are three separate areas. They were all forced together, and it's in a very difficult situation. Where do we go in Iraq? You served in Afghanistan. You know, if you were in Congress, if you're elected, you're one of 435. Obviously, the president makes policy, whether it be a Democrat or a Republican or who knows what, independent next year. Where do we go in Iraq? What have we done right? What have we done wrong?
Well, look, unfortunately, we got into that country back in 2003 based on evidence that unfortunately wasn't there. And unfortunately, we left that country at a time when we shouldn't have because it created a vacuum. And I think that's why you realize that we're going to have a limited force left in Afghanistan, because there needs to be something there, some type of presence by the United States in order to prevent what has happened in Iraq. So that is why I think we're going to, up to 2017, have 5,000 troops in Afghanistan. Because we don't want we don't want what happened in Iraq to happen in Afghanistan. And we need to ensure that basically there's a presence there, and so that we don't see the vacuum created as it did in Iraq.
One of the things that your father, Leon Panetta's office had was well known for was its tremendous response to constituent issues, Social Security, federal pensions, Medicare, and your mother, who ran those offices, and I was city editor and associate editor at the Herald, and was a very tenacious, strong-willed, hardworking person, and she obviously was probably more than the right arm of Leon. What will you do to see you can do that? And also Sam Farr, Congressman Sam Farr's office, has been responsive to constituent issues. How do you make sure as a congressperson, if you are elected, that the problems, which may be insignificant when you consider the national and international issues, but to the constituent who's not getting his or her Medicare or who's concerned about where the spouse could be buried in a veteran cemetery, how do you keep that hands-on presence so good and so responsive?
Let me tell you, one of the things that inspires me to run for this position are the stories that I hear on a weekly basis about the constituent services that were provided to the people of this community by our past representatives. And what you realize is that all politics is local. There's no doubt about that, because people make it a point to come up to me and tell me about the services they received from their representatives. And what's amazing is that these are stories that took place over 30, 40 years ago, yet they still make it a point to come up and tell me how their representative helped them with an immigration issue. Their representative helped them with an affordable housing issue. And their representative helped them receive the benefits that they deserved, be it as a veteran, be it as a senior citizen. That's the type of service that people need to realize is important to the community. The other day, I met somebody who came up to me, and he said, Jimmy Panetta. I said, yes. He said, let me tell you, back in the early 1980s, I was in Fordo. I was in the military. I was based in Korea, and I was having a problem getting moved back here to Fort Ord, where my family was. Nobody was listening to me. I contacted the representative in this area. 3 months later, I was transferred back to Fort Ord. I retired here. I stayed here. I raised my family here. And guess what? They're here now with their families contributing to this community. So just by doing your job as a U.S. representative, you realize that you can affect not only that person, not only his family, but this community. And I couldn't imagine serving in another capacity.
And I can remember that your father would, I think he would take the red eye to D.C. and then come back on Friday, and I can still see him tooling around downtown Monterey in a VW Bug. He was very visible.
Yeah.
And I presume you're the youngest of three sons. I presume he was there and he was visible for you on the weekend. But as a little kid, you probably wondered why Dad has to go away every week, with the exception of recesses in Congress. The district is approximately 52% Democrat. The Republican and independent numbers are in the low 20s. There's been a Democrat representing the district. The district has changed boundaries somewhat and has also changed numbers. But since your father was elected in 76, is it the Democrats' candidate district to lose? In other words, given the numbers, nothing is a shoo-in, but an outsider would say, given the numbers, the Democratic candidate will have an easier time, far easier than the Republican candidate.
Well, I think what it comes down to is that the people of this district vote for the person and not necessarily the party. And I say that based on the fact that people come up to me and say, you know what, I'm a Republican, but I'm voting for you because of what you have done. And that's kind of been how it's been determined in this area. You had Sam Farr, who was a Democratic congressman. Yet he continued to get elected with extraordinary numbers. The representative before him continued to get elected with amazing numbers. Why? Because the people of this area, I believe, vote for the person and not the party. And yes, it's a majority Democratic district with a significant amount of decline in the states and about 21% Republican. And sure, there are some that vote the party line. But I think what it comes down to is that as a representative from this area, you need to care about this area. You need to care about the people of this area. And that's what's important to the voters of this area. Is that the right person that's going to represent me? Is that the right person that's going to be my bridge to Washington, D.C. and back. Let me tell you, I get asked, what's the number one issue you hear from the people you're talking to throughout this district? And the number one issue I hear is accessibility. Are you going to be accessible to us? Are you going to listen to us? And that's what's important to the people in this area.
Let me ask you a few more as we begin to wrap up. Who are your heroes?
Well, I grew up with one of them. There's no doubt about that. In the sense that my mother was an amazing person and an amazing public servant. She was here at home dealing with three pretty wild boys. At the same time, dealing with the demands of being a district director in this district. We didn't have any help. We didn't have any household help in the sense that there was no, we didn't have babysitters. We had our mother, and we knew that our father was coming home on the weekends. And so she was at the tip of the spear when dealing with us. And we knew that if we didn't deal with her, we were going to deal with my father.
Second Amendment. Any restrictions on the magazines? The amount of weaponry they can have. That's certainly a hot button issue in this country.
Right. Well. Look. You know, I respect, and I think we all honor the Second Amendment. But the fact is that, you know, look, as a prosecutor, I've been witness to gun violence firsthand. As a nation, we've been witness to gun violence in Newtown, in Aurora, San Bernardino. And unfortunately, there has been a resistance to stem gun violence. And U.S. representatives don't get elected to Congress to send tweets demonstrating their prayers and their thoughts. And as Congressman Murphy from Connecticut stated, the only thoughts that we should be having are what to do to stop gun violence. And the only prayers that we should be making are ones of forgiveness if we don't do anything about this. So I understand why the administration took this executive action in regards to the licenses, in regards to ATF agents, boosting the number of ATF agents, and also expanding mental health services, $500 million. That's not that much, but it's something. And also looking at new technology for weapons in order to prevent them being stolen or them being only sure that they're used by the owners. So, look, I admire that. I think that's correct. But the fact is that it's going to take more than executive action. It's going to take long-term legislative solutions by the U.S. Congress to come together to ensure that this violence is stopped.
Roe v. Wade, more than 40 years, always out there, always an issue by both the people who are defined as pro-choice and people who are defined as pro-life. What's your take on, and particularly dealing with the trimester involved?
Sure. Well, look, it was the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade this past weekend on Friday, and I attended a couple events. And I'm a Catholic. I admit that. And my wife is one of four that were adopted. So we are not pro-abortion. We are pro-choice. And we understand the importance of a woman's right to ensure to make that decision, but also a woman's right to access to reproductive health services. And that's the important thing. And that's what people have to realize, that you cannot defund Planned Parenthood, because it's a small percentage. Abortion, having those types of medical services, is a small percentage of Planned Parenthood. But you have to look at all the reproductive, the health services that they provide to women, and which makes you realize how important it is, and how important it is to maintain that type of funding to Planned Parenthood.
In this rat-a-tat fashion of questions I'm throwing at you in no particular order here, ISIS, what should we do that we're not doing? What strategy do we have? Is it sufficient strategy looking back on what happened in Paris and in San Bernardino most recently? And how much of a danger is it to the average American?
Yeah. Well, let me take that piecemeal. I was fortunate enough to serve in Afghanistan with a special operations team. And in that sense, I saw the special operations team work hand in hand with our intelligence agencies to find, fix, and eliminate high-value targets. Targets that I have no doubt wanted to do harm to our men and women in uniform, and if allowed, would do harm to the United States of America. And so we have the capabilities. We decimated the al-Qaeda leadership. We've done it before. We can do it again. And I am confident that our military, our intelligence agencies, are utilizing all of their resources in order to go after these terrorists who are trying to hide out in Syria, in Iraq, in other areas of the in Libya, and other areas in the Middle East. But it takes time. It took time to go after al-Qaeda. It's going to take time to go after ISIS. Now, at the same time, it takes citizens of the United States to come forward and to speak up. You know, these terrorists, if you look at San Bernardino, these terrorists, that couple basically was completely under the radar, as has been seen. And it reminded me of my time as working with criminal street gangs, because for a while there, criminal street gangs, they show their loyalty to the gang through tattoos, through the clothing that they're wearing, through their admissions, through their hand signs. Yet that also helped us prove the case against them. And so you see gang members adapting and not getting tattoos, not claiming loyalty to the gang, yet still carrying out the crimes of the gang. And I think you see that, you see the ways of terrorists developing as well, in the sense that they're going to be under the radar, but it takes everybody to see it, to figure it out, and bring it forward so that we know about it.
One of the questions I asked Republican hopeful Casey Lucius last summer, and this is when Sam Foer, as far as anyone knew, was still going to be running, what were the differences between herself and Sam Foer? You've spent times at forums with Casey Lucius. What would you say are some significant differences between you and she, you and her?
She's a Republican. I mean, look, if you are a Republican, you are going to have to vote with the Republican leadership when you get to the House. And if you don't, how are you going to get things done?
If you are elected, what committees, and we may be getting ahead of ourselves, but what committees would you like to be on, or subcommittees?
You'd be remiss if you weren't on the Agriculture Committee, being from this area. I look forward to being on the Agricultural Committee back in Washington, D.C., so that I can continue to support the number one industry in this area.
The nuclear pact with Iran. Even supporters, many of them said it's not great, but it's better than nothing. Opponents are pretty vociferous against it. What's your take on it, and also the concern that some people have that it frees Iran, gives them an inordinate amount of money in which they can fund terrorist activities?
Look, it's not the best deal, but it's what we have now. And so we need to not trust and verify. That's what it comes down to. We need to ensure that Iran continues to take the steps to uphold their part of the bargain. And if not, we need to make sure that we do the right thing in order to have them live up to their side of the bargain. That's what it comes down to. Look, they did a missile test a couple weeks back. One of their most powerful missiles they launched and they tested. There should be repercussions for those types of actions. And the United States needs to be on the forefront.
We're talking here with Jimmy Panetta, a prosecutor with the Monterey County District Attorney's Office, who is seeking the Democratic nomination for the 20th congressional seat. The filing does not close until March 11th. We're not sure how many people will put their hat in the ring. The way it works is that the two leading vote getters in the June primary advance to November. It could be a Republican or Democrat. It could be two Republicans. It could be two Democrats. That's the way it is in this area. One last question, Jimmy. Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
Lou, it's in this position as a candidate for 20th congressional seat. The reason that I'm running is because of my sense of belonging to this area, which has created my sense of service to this area. We were always told that because we were allowed to live the reality of my grandfather's American dream, we should always give back to this country and this community that gave us so much. And so I have lived up to that sense of service in my adult life, be it my time in the military, be it my time as a prosecutor in Oakland and in Salinas, and be it my time serving on the number of boards. And what I've realized is that I can continue to serve as that bridge. Last week, I had a sentencing of a defendant who committed a murder of a six-year-old child. And throughout that trial, I had the victim's family sitting in the gallery, staring at me the whole time. And I kind of wasn't sure what they were staring at. And so I got up and I talked to them, and they were Spanish speaking, and I asked them, is everything okay? And the response was, everything is fine. We are relying on you. And so I see that as basically in that position, you are a bridge to the system. You are a bridge to the courts. You are a bridge to justice. And so I look forward to continuing to be a bridge if I'm fortunate enough to get elected by the people of this district, to be a bridge from this area to Washington, D.C., to the governmental services, and back, because I've seen firsthand that is what is most important to the people of this area.
Thank you. This has been Lewis Leader with Jimmy Panetta. Jimmy is seeking the Democratic nomination for the 20th congressional seat, and then, of course, seeking election to Congress. That won't be determined until November of 2016. This is Lewis Leader for National Public Radio Station KAZU. Thank you.